New York, this is Democracy Now!
I cannot believe myself for sure. I cannot yet comprehend that this is real and that Allah is with us.
Tears of joy as Egypt releases longtime political prisoner Alaa Abdel Fattah as he reunites with his family in Cairo. Other than for a few months, Alaa has been in prison since 2013 on various charges, including spreading false news, quote unquote. His family and supporters say he was targeted for his pro-democracy activism. He was a leading voice in the 2011 Arab Spring protests that toppled the Mubarak dictatorship and was repeatedly targeted by the current President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. We'll speak with Alaa's aunt, the renowned author Adef Souef, and with journalist Sharif Abdelkaddous, who knew him well. Then to Chicago, where ICE agents threw a Democratic congressional candidate to the ground.
This past Friday, I was assaulted by ICE alongside some other protesters. That day was probably the most harrowing day of protest I have ever attended in my life. Partly because anything we dealt with didn't hold a candle to what the people trapped inside that facility are enduring.
Then California Governor Gavin Newsom signs the No Secret Police Act into law, banning all law enforcement, including ICE agents, from covering their faces while conducting raids.
I'll be signing a bill, the first in the nation, saying enough. ICE, unmask. What are you afraid of? What are you afraid of?
We'll speak with the ACLU of Southern California and with New York Congressmember Nydia Velazquez. She's introduced the No Masks for ICE Act into Congress. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip killed at least 38 Palestinians and injured another 190 over the past 24 hours. An estimated 500,000 Palestinians remain in Gaza City, despite an advance by Israeli tanks, paratroopers, explosive-laden robots, and remote-controlled vehicles. Among the latest victims is a 5-year-old Palestinian girl named Noor, whose parents frantically searched the rubble of their Gaza City home Monday after it was flattened by an Israeli strike.
Bring me Noor, bring me Noor. In 7 years, I've only had her. I do not have any children except her. Noor is under the rubble. Where is Noor?
Noor was found under the debris, but later died in an ambulance. Her family had fled their home in the Zaytun neighborhood after it was destroyed in a previous strike. Meanwhile, Gaza's health ministry is warning patients face certain death at hospitals that have nearly exhausted fuel supplies needed for generators that power life-saving medical equipment. France has formally recognized a Palestinian state for the first time. President Emmanuel Macron declared France's recognition Monday as the United Nations convened its General Assembly for the 80th consecutive year.
Le temps est venu.
The time has come.
C'est pourquoi.
This is why.
Fidèle à l'engagement historique.
Loyalty to my country's historic commitment to the Middle East.
Pour la paix entre le
for
peuple
peace among Israeli people.
Et le peuple palestinien.
And the Palestinian people.
Je déclare que la France
I declare that France recognizes today
de
the
Palestine.
State of Palestine.
Andorra, Belgium, Luxembourg, Malta, and Monaco also declared their recognition of a Palestinian state Monday. With France's recognition, the United States is now the only member of the UN Security Council not to recognize Palestine. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu slammed the declarations as a, quote, huge reward to terrorism, unquote, and said a Palestinian state, quote, will not happen. In Italy, tens of thousands of people took to the streets of dozens of cities Monday as Italian labor unions led a nationwide 24-hour general strike to demand an end to Israel's assault on Gaza. In Rome, tens of thousands joined a march that blocked a major highway. There were similar scenes in Bologna, where student protesters occupied university lecture halls. In Venice, police fired water cannons to disperse protesters, while dock workers led marches in Genoa and other port cities seeking to block weapons exports to Israel. This is Genoa resident Dario Rossi.
Genoa is a port and therefore the ideal place to try and stop this trade in arms that are fueling genocide. These weapons should not be allowed to pass because our laws prohibit trading arms with countries that are at war and violate human rights. Yet they pass through unhindered. Fortunately, we have a very combative group of dock workers here who are fighting tooth and nail and dragging the entire citizenry into this protest, which is spreading nationally and internationally.
The U.S. Supreme Court is allowing President Trump to fire the Federal Trade Commission's last remaining Democrat, Rebecca Kelly Slaughter, and is set to hear oral arguments in December on whether federal law grants presidents the power to fire officials of independent agencies. In her dissent, Justice Elena Kagan wrote, quote, President Trump may now remove, so says the majority, though Congress said differently, any member he wishes for any reason or no reason at all. And he may thereby extinguish the agency's bipartisanship and independence, Kagan wrote. ABC has announced Jimmy Kimmel's show will return to the airwaves tonight, after it was indefinitely suspended following FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr's threats to revoke the broadcast licenses of affiliates over comments Kimmel made about Charlie Kirk's assassin. In a statement, the Walt Disney Company, which owns ABC, said, quote, last Wednesday, we made the decision to suspend production on the show to avoid further inflaming a tense situation at an emotional moment for our country. It's a decision we made because we felt some of the comments were ill-timed and thus insensitive. We've spent the last days having thoughtful conversations with Jimmy, and after those conversations, we reached the decision to return the show on Tuesday, unquote. This statement comes as a movement to boycott Disney Plus, Hulu, and other Disney-owned subscription services was gathering steam in the wake of Kimmel's suspension. Meanwhile, Sinclair Broadcast Group, which owns dozens of ABC affiliates, said it will not air Jimmy Kimmel Live on its stations and will replace it with news programming. On Monday, unions led a rally for free speech outside Jimmy Kimmel's studio in Hollywood. Joining the protest was California Democratic Congressmember Laura Friedman.
Is the Trump administration deciding what you can watch on television, what jokes he thinks you should be able to hear? He does not want dissent, and he's not above using the highest powers of the law to clamp down on dissent. That's un-American, it's dangerous, and it's something that we need to raise the alarm about.
President Trump's proposing sweeping changes to how children are vaccinated, saying the MMR vaccine should be broken up into separate shots. At a White House press conference flanked by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Centers for Medicare and Medicaid head Dr. Mehmet Oz, Trump said children should instead receive separate shots for measles, mumps and rubella, though he apparently forgot the name rubella. Trump also recommended removing aluminum from vaccines and said parents should wait until their children are 12 to vaccinate against hepatitis B, falsely stating the viral infection is only sexually transmitted, even though it can also be spread through open wounds, contaminated objects during birth or through breastfeeding. Trump said his recommendations were, quote, based on what I feel, unquote. He made the remarks while promoting unproven claims that vaccines and the common painkiller, acetaminophen, cause autism, despite decades of research showing no proven links.
Effective immediately, the FDA will be notifying physicians that the use of acetaminophen, is that okay? Which is basically commonly known as Tylenol during pregnancy, can be associated with a very increased risk of autism. So taking Tylenol is not good.
The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists called the announcement irresponsible, adding, quote, it's highly unsettling that our federal health agencies are willing to make an announcement that'll affect the health and well-being of millions of people without the backing of reliable data, unquote. In immigration news, hundreds of people who were once detained at the troubled immigration jail in the Florida Everglades, dubbed Alligator Alcatraz, have disappeared. The Miami Herald reports about two-thirds of the 1,800 immigrants who were held there in July have gone missing from ICE's online database, with their families unable to locate them. Earlier this month, a federal appeals court ruled the jail could continue to operate despite reports of abuse. The Trump administration's trying to limit the enforcement of the Fair Housing Act. That's according to the New York Times review of dozens of emails, memos, and other internal communications, as well as interviews with current and former workers at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD. Speaking to the Times, lawyers say they've been blocked from communicating with clients without approval from a Trump appointee. Staff members also detail how their fair housing work is being dismissed as an offshoot of DEI. In response, Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren said her office is reviewing documents shared by whistleblowers inside HUD.
Documents detail how the Trump administration apparently views the office that enforces civil rights protections in housing as a, quote, optics problem. Imagine thinking that defending black families from being denied a mortgage because they're black, or protecting a mom and her kids from living with an abusive father, is a, quote, optics problem. Imagine thinking that it's an optics problem to help the dad with a bad knee whose landlord refuses to install a handrail on the stairs.
Prominent Egyptian blogger Ala Abdel Fattah has been released from prison along with several other prisoners following the announcement of presidential pardons Monday in Egypt. Ala spent most of the last 12 years in and out of prison due to his political activism. Ala Abdel Fattah reunited with his mother, Leila Swaif, who'd been on a hunger strike for months demanding her son's freedom. Also celebrating Ala's release Monday at their home in Cairo was his sister, Sana Saif.
We wish for this moment to come for all the families of political detainees. I'm praying that this is the end of tragedies in our family and that Ala is allowed to travel and to be with his son.
We'll have more on Ala's pardon and release later in the broadcast. In related news, a human rights investigation uncovered a mass grave in Egypt's North Sinai, which researchers believe was used by the Egyptian military to bury the bodies of victims of extrajudicial killings. The Colombian government's terminated arms purchases from the United States, its largest military partner, as tensions rise with the Trump administration over accusations Colombia is failing to combat cocaine trafficking. Colombian President Gustavo Petro denounced the U.S. intervention, saying his government, quote, will not be blackmailed and that more cocaine has been seized under his administration than any previous presidents. In more news from Colombia, 12 former soldiers have been sentenced to 8 years of reparations work over their role in the extrajudicial executions of 135 civilians during Colombia's U.S.-backed conflict. The killings were part of what became known as the false positive scandal when U.S.-backed Colombian soldiers massacred thousands of civilians, falsely counting them as rebel fighters. The White House said Monday it had dismissed an offer by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to engage in direct talks with President Trump aimed at de-escalating a U.S. naval buildup near Venezuela's coast. The brush-off came after Trump declared he'd ordered the bombing of another vessel he alleged was trafficking drugs to the United States. Trump shared video on his social media site Truth Social of an apparent airstrike on a speedboat, writing in all caps, quote, stop selling fentanyl, narcotics, and illegal drugs in America and committing violence and terrorism against Americans, unquote. Trump did not specify where the bombing occurred, the name of the alleged terrorist organization involved, or who conducted the attack. The strikes appear to have occurred outside any declared war zone, targeting civilians who pose no immediate threat. Legal experts say such extrajudicial killings violate both U.S. and international law and constitute war crimes. And the International Criminal Courts charged former Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte with 3 counts of crimes against humanity. Duterte is accused of orchestrating the extrajudicial killings of dozens of people between 2013 and 18 as part of his devastating so-called war on drugs. The UN estimates over 8,600 people were killed during Duterte's rule, with some estimates suggesting the true toll could be 3 times higher. Last year, Duterte admitted under oath he oversaw a death squad of gangsters while he served as mayor of the southern city of Davao. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York. Juan Gonzalez is in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, Egypt's most prominent political prisoner, Ali Abdel Fattah, has been released and reunited with his family after being granted a presidential pardon on Monday, along with several other prisoners. Ala is 43 years old. He spent most of the last 12 years of his life in prison. The writer, blogger, and political dissident was a leading voice in the 2011 Arab Spring protests that toppled the Mubarak dictatorship and has been repeatedly targeted by the current authoritarian government of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Most recently, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison for a Facebook post. That sentence ended last September, but authorities refused to release him until now, saying his 2 years of pretrial detention didn't count. Monday's pardon comes after years of international pressure led by his family to free Ala, including in the United Kingdom, where he also holds citizenship. Both Ala and his mother, Leila Swaif, went on extended hunger strike to draw attention to his case. This is one of Ala's sisters, Sana Swaif, speaking at the family home after Ala's release.
I cannot believe myself for sure. I cannot yet comprehend that this is real and that Ala is with us. I cannot believe that I'm seeing him here at home among us normally. I guess it will feel more real when we go to sleep, wake up, and find him present, and when his son arrives here from traveling. I'm really happy.
Sana is one of Ala's two sisters, and this is Ala's mother, Professor Leila Swaif.
Despite our great joy, the biggest joy is when there are no political prisoners. The big and real joy is when there are no political prisoners.
We go now to London, where we're joined with Leila Swaif's sister, the renowned writer Adef Swaif. She is Ala Abdel Fattah's aunt, the author of several books, including The Map of Love, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and Cairo, My City, Our Revolution. And here in New York, we're joined by Sharif Abdelkaddous, award-winning journalist, Middle East, North Africa editor at Dropsite News. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Adef, if you can share your feelings today, just 24 hours after it was announced that your nephew was pardoned.
Amy, hi. Hello to you and to all your viewers. I really don't even know how to describe my feelings. It's a tremendous relief. We keep saying, is this over? Can we stop now? I haven't seen Ala yet. I've spoken to him on the phone. So tremendous, tremendous relief. And also a lot of a very active hope that this is the beginning of the release of a lot of other political prisoners as well.
You're showing images of your sister, the Cairo University math professor, Leila Swaif, hugging her son. She and Ala himself almost died in their hunger strike. She did it in Britain, thinking that was the pressure point that would bring him home. The British prime minister putting pressure on Sisi, and of course, Ala in prison. What about their health?
Well, they're looking, I think, pretty haggard, pretty gaunt. This is masked to an extent. Maybe even highlighted really by how clearly happy and joyful they are, but I think that getting back to health, getting back to a good weight, is really paramount for them both. Now they've been under a lot of stress, and hunger strikes are very, very difficult, and Leila's lasted for so very long.
And Adef, I wanted to ask you, for those of our audience who are not familiar with your nephew's case, could take us back to he was imprisoned twice under Sisi. Could you talk about the reasons the government gave and the fight to free him?
Well, he went to trial twice, and both times he received 5-year sentences. The first time, which was in 2014, was actually the culmination of before President Sisi. It was also President Mohamed Morsi, and before that, President Mubarak. Ali has been in prison under every system that has ruled in Egypt. But these two long stretches, 2014 and 2019, the first one was for taking part in a silent protest outside the Senate or Parliament to urge them not to allow military trials for civilians. He was there for 10 minutes. And he was arrested 2 days later and charged with unlawful protest and even with organizing it, and sentenced to 5 years. And I think there were 13 other people, or maybe even 23 in that case with him, and they all received jail sentences. He served that sentence from 2014 until March 2019. And when he came out, he was under surveillance order, which meant he had to report every evening at 6 p.m. to his local police station and spend the night there. And go home at 6 in the morning. And he did that for 6 months. And then in September 2019, he was arrested again, charged with a menu of charges, and then eventually 2 years later tried on a charge of spreading false information. What he had done was he had reposted a post about a prisoner dying in custody. And the post was truthful. The prisoner had died in custody. Ali reposted it and was charged and was tried and was sentenced to 5 years. The 5 years ended September last year, and he was not released. And at that point, Leila, his mother, decided that that things couldn't wait any longer, really, that more than 11 years of her son's life had been taken from him, and she started her hunger strike. And now, a year later, we're here celebrating his release with tremendous relief.
Well, it certainly is a relief for your family, but as Leila mentioned in her statement, there are thousands, some people say from 20 to 60,000 political prisoners still in Egypt. What about the... Could you talk about the failure of the rest of the world to put the pressure on the Egyptian government to release these people?
Well, the various human rights organizations, the international human rights organizations, are actually doing a lot of work on political prisoners in Egypt. And, of course, our hope is that... you know, the release of somebody as high profile as Ali would persuade the Egyptian government to open the doors to other prisoners as well. And particularly really at this moment when Egypt is having such an external issue with what is happening in Gaza, in Palestine, and when the Egyptian government is actually aligned with the wishes of the Egyptian people to not allow the forced displacement of the Palestinians. And so this is probably a very good moment for that alignment to actually be translated into releases for a lot of political prisoners.
Adif Swift, you were the first family member, right, he talked to. Can you explain the confusion yesterday when your sister, Professor Leila Swift from Sana, his sister, trucked out to the prison thinking they would greet him there, but he wasn't there?
Well, yeah, this is a kind of like dramatic comic ending, we hope ending, to this story. Yesterday morning, the presidential pardon that we had all been waiting for was signed, and the press covered it. So we learned that had happened, and Ali's lawyer posted it. And so Leila and Saneh got into a car with a couple of other friends and drove to the prison to be there to welcome him when he was released. They knew, of course, that there was a process that had to happen before he was released, but they couldn't just stay home. So they drove off to the prison, which is about an hour and a half away from Cairo, along the desert road towards the north coast. And So all day, they were waiting outside the prison. There were friends waiting at a nearby gas station. We were waiting here. Everybody was just spending the day waiting. And we knew that the process through which the release would actually happen was taking place, but we had no idea how long it would take. And word was that it wouldn't happen that night. It would probably be tomorrow, i.e. today. But Leila was not giving up and was insistent that she would wait outside the prison in case they released him. Well, what actually happened was that at about 11 p.m., I got a phone call from a number that I didn't recognize. I didn't answer it. And then I got a message from that same number saying, "Answer me, this is Ali." And I couldn't believe it. So I called him and he said, "It's Ali, it's Ali. Ahdef, where are you?" I said, "Where are you?" He said, "Yeah, I'm out. I haven't moved, but where are you?" He said, "I'm outside the house and I can't get in. Where's my mom?" And I said, "Well, your mom is at the prison gates waiting for you." So then we called my brother, who went round and opened, unlocked the door for him. And friends started coming round, and we called Leila and Saneh, and they turned round and drove back to meet him. So basically, yeah, the process had happened, and he'd been driven out, and they hadn't noticed, and he'd been driven from the prison the hour and a half to his local police station, went into the police station. The police station drove him to his house and said, "Are you fine here?" And he said, "Yes." And they left him there, and he rang the doorbell and nobody opened because his mom was at the prison gates.
I mean, this is just remarkable. After all these years, more than a decade, Sharif, you know Ala well, you've interviewed him. He was a leader of Tahrir Square, of the Arab Spring in Egypt. His mom going to Britain to put pressure there, seeing that within Egypt, she didn't seem to succeed in securing his release. So if the British government, talk about that, what ultimately happened. Both Leila Swaif and Ala are British Egyptian citizens.
Yeah. Let me just first say that Ala's release from prison is a moment of light in this time of darkness. And his freedom is a testament to the power of hope, of resilience, of struggle, and ultimately of solidarity and love, the love of his family who fought and sacrificed so much, and the love of one's chosen family, Ala's friends and comrades who around the world campaigned tirelessly and fought for years and never gave up. When I speak about his family, I'm talking about Ahdef, talking about his cousin, Omar Robert Hamilton, who helped spearhead the campaign for him, his sisters, Mona and Sanet. You know, Sanet spent over 3 years in prison, much of it being put behind bars for advocacy around her brother. But perhaps most of all, for his mother, Leila Swaif, who sacrificed herself. She sacrificed her body, the body that gave birth to Ala, and went on hunger strike last year that lasted over 9 months, that really brought her to the doorstep of death. And her willingness to put her life on the line for her son's freedom, for her son's life, is what really pressured the British government to really act and negotiate on a real level. So what happened was, Ahdef mentioned the different imprisonments, and when Ala was sentenced in December of 2021, to 5 years. A couple months later, he began a hunger strike. And the family announced that they had obtained British citizenship for Ala to get them out of what they called their impossible ordeal, because it didn't seem like the Egyptian government was ever going to let him go. And they decided that they needed the British government to then pressure the Egyptian government to let him out. Ala was on hunger strike for over 200 days when Egypt hosted the climate conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, UN COP conference that you covered, Amy. And timed to coincide with the first day of the conference, he announced that he was going to go on a water strike. And this brought to the forefront, at the climate conference, Egypt's, Ala's case himself, but Egypt's dismal rights record. And I think for the first time at a UN climate conference, inextricably tied climate justice to human rights in a very profound way. After 5 days, he collapsed in what he described as a near-death experience, and he was revived. During that time, we saw massive protests inside the conference. We saw the White House, the French president, the German chancellor, then British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, all publicly called for Alet's release. He wasn't released, but what he did accomplish with his own hunger strike was his transfer outside of the maximum security two-wing of Tora prison, which is known as Scorpion prison. He had been held there for over three years, with no books or reading material, no sunlight or fresh air, no exercise or time outside of his cell, no bedding, no pen and paper, no clock. And Ala is very tough. He has a very strong intellect and will, but this was beginning to break him. And at some point a few months earlier, he had expressed suicidal thoughts. So they transferred him to this newly built prison in Wadi Natroun. But then he was supposed to be released last year in September, at the end of September. And the Egyptian government, in violation of Egypt's own penal code, did not count the 2 years of pretrial detention that he had spent in his sentence and said that he was going to continue until January 2027. And at this point, Leyla Swift decided that that was not going to happen. And so she embarked on this hunger strike, and she conducted most of it in London. She would spend most mornings outside the headquarters of the Foreign Office in London in this protest. By February of this year, she had lost a third of her body weight, and she collapsed, or her blood sugar levels collapsed, and she was hospitalized. And this prompted, just a few days later, the British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, to have a call with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. And then we saw a flurry of diplomatic movement with Britain's National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell, who helped broker the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland, begin these talks. And this eventually culminated in July. Alet was removed from the terrorism list. And eventually, he was pardoned. So I think we also, just one final thing, we have to say that Alet is free, but he doesn't have justice. He's spent more than half his adult life behind bars. His father died while he was in prison and while Sanet was in prison as well.
His father died while Alet was in prison?
The father died while Alet was in prison and Sanet was in prison in 2014. Alet's son Khaled, who's now 13, has grown up without him. And beyond Alet, there are still so many thousands of political prisoners in Egypt, including dozens who are behind bars simply for speaking out in solidarity with Palestine and against Israel's genocide in Gaza. And Palestine is central to Alet's politics and his thinking, and he was able to visit Gaza many years ago. He has a beautiful essay in the anthology of his writings called Palestine on My Mind that I encourage everyone to read. But yes, Ala is free, and the photos and footage of him in Cairo with his family are joyous beyond comprehension. He spent last night in his bed for the first time in 11 years, and the world has been made that much richer with him finally back among us.
Well, we thought we'd end this segment. Clearly an Ala Day for so many around the world with Ala's freedom. With Ala in his own words, going way back, we first interviewed Ala Abdel Fattah on Democracy Now! In February of 2011, during our special coverage of the Tahrir uprising of the Arab Spring. And I've just been told that we do have someone on the phone right now, so we're going to go right to that person. Can you tell us who you are and where you are?
This is Ala Abdel Fattah. I am an activist in this revolution. I'm standing in front of the TV building in Cairo.
Okay, tell us, Ala. It's great to have you with us, a prominent Egyptian blogger, democracy activist. What is happening in front of the presidential palace, one of a number of new places that are being occupied by protesters, like Egyptian state TV as well, and the parliament?
In front of the TV building, it's a big crowd. We can't shut down the TV building because of its shape, and it's heavily barricaded by the army. But what we're trying to do is put pressure on the employees working inside to join us, to revolt and refuse to spread state propaganda.
So that was Ala Abdel Fattah in February of 2011. In December of that year, I interviewed him again after he spent nearly 2 months in prison, which prevented him from attending the birth of his son, Khaled. I asked Ala to describe his conditions in prison at the time.
The first 5 days, I was put in a pretty bad prison. Now, all prisons
well, all prisons in the world are bad. Like, you know, losing your freedom is quite tough. But also all prisons in Egypt are in very poor conditions. And so even if they don't torture you, just spending one night there is already, you know, a bit too much. But I was in a particularly bad prison, and they made sure to put me in a particularly bad cell and to deny me, you know, any comfort. So, for instance, I was in a complete darkness for 5 days.
So that's Egypt's most prominent political prisoner, Alaa Abdel Fattah, in 2011. He has just been released from prison after well over a decade, 13 years, and reunited with his family. I want to thank our guest, Sharif Abdelkaddous, award-winning journalist, Middle East, North Africa editor at DropSite News, and Adef Swif, Alaa's aunt, and renowned author, speaking to us from London, the first family member he got to speak to yesterday after he was freed. Next up, California Governor Gavin Newsom signs the No Secret Police Act, banning all law enforcement, including ICE agents, from covering their faces while conducting raids. Stay with us.
What happened to the words for which we once stood? I will stand for you. Would you stand for me? Lend a hand to you. Would you lend a hand to me? Everybody deserves to be free. It's closed tonight, so I leave the candle burning to light your way home. Won't give up the fight. The
Everybody Deserves to Be Free, by the Resistance Revival Chorus, performed at Town Hall on Sunday night for the Voices for Gaza program. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to California, where Governor Gavin Newsom has signed into law the No Secret Police Act, banning all law enforcement, including ICE agents, from covering their faces while conducting raids. The ban's a response to recent immigration raids in Los Angeles and other areas where ICE officials made mass arrests while heavily masked. This is Governor Newsom speaking before signing the legislation.
The impact of these policies all across this city, our state and nation, are terrifying. It's like a dystopian sci-fi movie. Unmarked cars, people en masse, people quite literally disappearing, no due process, no rights in a democracy where we have rights. Immigrants have rights, and we have the right to stand up and push back.
The new California law was quickly denounced by Trump administration officials, including Tricia McLaughlin, Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at Homeland Security. She said, quote, a sanctuary politician is trying to outlaw officers wearing masks to protect themselves from being doxxed and targeted by known and suspected terrorist sympathizers, unquote. The acting U.S. attorney for the Central District of California, Bill Asaley, didn't just denounce the law, but said ICE agents should not follow it. This is U.S. Attorney Asaley during an interview with KCAL News.
We're not going to follow it. The law has no force or effect on federal agencies. The state of California has no jurisdiction to regulate anything that we do in the federal government, and I've instructed our agents to disregard it. So we will continue doing our operations as we have been doing them. The reason the officers wear face masks...
We're now joined by two guests. Ava Bitran is the Director of Immigrants' Rights at the ACLU of Southern California, joining us from Riverside, California. And in Harlem, we're joined by New York Congressmember Nydia Velazquez, who introduced the No Mask for ICE Act in Congress, which would bar agents nationally from wearing facial coverings during enforcement actions and require them to wear clothing displaying their name and affiliation with ICE. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Ava Bitran, let's begin with you in California. The significance of the No Secret Agents Act being signed into law, and yet Trump officials saying, do not follow the law to ICE agents. Talk about where this law came from.
This law came from the enormous siege of our immigrant people here in Southern California that we have seen the federal government, beginning in June, carry out all the way until now. What we saw were bands of masked, powerfully armed, and really swiftly moving federal agents kidnapping our community members. And that's what prompted California to react, to say, this is not how we handle our immigrant people. For us, it is important that due process prevail, that transparency prevail, and that we free our people from the kind of siege of kidnappers that's come out to Southern California.
But Eva, some people have criticized this law because it has loopholes, that it allows masks, exceptions for SWAT teams and undercover operations. How do you respond to those concerns?
My understanding is that what this law is trying to do is to take us back from the era of routine sort of masking based on completely foundationless officer claims of fear, and back to sort of the technical necessities that officers would claim in previous years or previous administrations. And the loopholes are designed to sort of protect for that.
I'd like to bring in a U.S. Congress member, Nydia Velazquez. Welcome back to Democracy Now! I wanted to ask you about the legislation that you've introduced. What are the specifics of the legislation, and also your hopes, your expectations of whether it can pass or not?
Good morning, and thank you for having me, Amy and Juan. So, as you see, the Trump administration is already saying that they are not going to comply with the law passed by California. And this is why we need to have a federal solution that will apply nationwide, and it will ban the use of masks, and it will require for any ICE agent to wear a uniform that clearly has their names and badge numbers, so that there is transparency and accountability.
Ava Letron, I just wanted to ask you, what does this mean? As Congressmember Velazquez tries to introduce a federal solution which would require these federal agents, on the ground, what is this now going to look like? First of all, it doesn't go into force, the No Secret Police Act, for until next year. Is that right? And how do you get ICE agents to comply if the no mask bill is not passed in Congress?
So that's right, that the bill does not go into effect until next year. But what we are really seeing is our communities coming out to demand an end altogether, masked or unmasked, to the lawless and unconstitutional raids that we have seen ICE carrying out here. We've seen people in the streets peacefully asking for ICE to leave our community neighbors alone. We've seen rapid response networks. We've seen community defense initiatives to keep people safe. And we know that's the path forward, whether or not legislation is in effect.
Yeah, and I'd like to go back to Representative Velazquez. The ICE data shows, for instance, in New York, that there's been nearly a six-fold increase in immigration detentions, going from 500 last year to almost 2,800 in the first 7 months of this year. What has been your experience, and as these ICE dragnets have spread across the country and even in your state?
Well, people are terrorized. Families do not want to, parents do not want to go to bring their children to school, to take the subway, to even appear before an immigration judge, because they know that they could be ambushed by ICE agent in those federal courts. People are terrorized. And this is the whole purpose of this mass deportation. It's just to terrorize, to instill fear. And my message to America is that we live in a country with laws. And everyone, every person, whether you are undocumented or not, You have a right to due process. And this use of police tactics, of agents wearing masks, of ambushing people in the streets in front of school children, is undermining safety and security in our communities. And we have to have a federal response. This administration is out of control and is affecting everyone, not only undocumented, bystanders who sometimes when they witness cars that are not identified, they think that a kidnap is taking place. But also, it incentivized criminals to wear masks so that they could commit crimes and assault immigrants in this country.
I wanted to ask you about Federal Plaza, 26 Federal Plaza. Congressmember Velasquez, a federal judge has granted a preliminary injunction to improve the conditions at this notorious ICE jail inside this federal building in Manhattan. Immigrants have described being imprisoned for days or weeks at a time in overcrowded cells without access to medication or proper sanitation, forced to sleep on the concrete floor, left hungry, without outside contact. In the last week, something like 11 of your fellow Democratic elected officials were arrested. Does ICE's use of masks, do you think, directly connect to the refusal to allow transparency in these facilities that now a federal judge is saying must be scrutinized? You just most recently, City Controller Brad Lander, who is campaigning around the city with Zoran Mamdani, and public advocate Jumaane Williams were among those arrested. Lander was arrested again.
Yes, you know, I have attempted twice, with Jerry Nadler, Goldman, and Adriano Espaillat to enter 26 Federal Plaza. And every time they have not allowed us to go into the 10th floor, Adriano Espaillat and myself, we forced ourselves to get into the 10th floor, but not into the detention facility itself, because they prevented us. They keep lying. They're saying that there is not a detention facility, that is a processing center. Yet we have seen videos that shows how crowded they are, and it is, and the unsanitary conditions, the lack of meals, showers, and so on. So the judge instructed them to improve the conditions. But not only do they lie, they are in violation of the statute, because we are within our legal right as members of Congress to go there and inspect the conditions of those facilities. And time and again, they prevent us from exercising our oversight responsibility.
Yeah, I just have one more question
again,
for
this is.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just have one more question for Ava before we break. There've been, as the Congresswoman said, there's been numerous arrests, up to more than 80 arrests of people who have been trying to assist these migrants when they're being rounded up by ICE. What is the ACLU's recommendation to people who are trying to support immigrants in these crises?
Yeah, we are really thankful to community members, immigrant and otherwise, who are coming out to give real testimony and witness to what's happening here. We continue to recommend that community members, if it is safe to do so, show up and record with their phones the interactions that are happening around them, to really give witness and also to force some transparency on what have been incredibly secretive operations. We also know that it's important for people to have Know Your Rights information, and we've seen our community members, Rapid Response Network members, shouting out Know Your Rights information to people as they are being detained, which has also been really powerful. At the ACLU, we have litigation that's been defending the rights of protesters who have been outraged about what's happening to immigrant neighbors here in LA, as well as litigation, both about the conditions at the short-term holding facilities and as well as at the sort of conduct of these unconstitutional operations. So we are watching, community is watching, our neighbors are looking out for one another. We know that what happens in LA becomes the blueprint for the rest of the country with these enforcement operations, and we're also trying to model how to mount a proper civil response.
Ava Bitron, I want to thank you for being with us, Director of Immigrant Rights at the ACLU of Southern California. And thank you to Congressmember Nydia Velazquez, who introduced the No Masks for ICE Act in Congress. We just mentioned Brad Lander and Zoran Mamdani. She has endorsed Zoran Mamdani. We're hoping to have the New York City mayoral candidate on Democracy Now! Tomorrow. Next, we go to Chicago, where ICE agents threw a Democratic congressional candidate to the ground. Back in 15 seconds.
Well, I woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. Woke up this morning with my mind set.
Woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom, the resistance revival chorus performing at Town Hall on Sunday for Voices for Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show in Chicago, where Juan is, as at least 10 people were arrested in protests outside an ICE facility Friday, with federal immigration agents firing pepper balls and using tear gas on the crowd. Democratic congressional candidate Kat Abugazele was thrown to the ground by ICE agents. People rallied outside the facility to protest the Trump administration's Operation Midway Blitz, which has led to the arrest of nearly 550 people in a sweeping crackdown on immigrants in the city. We are going to Chicago, where we're joined by Kat Abugazele, who is a progressive congressional candidate in Illinois' 9th District, which includes Chicago. Kat, welcome to Democracy Now! Describe what happened to you. We're going to show the video.
Yeah, so this is actually the third time that ICE has thrown me to the ground. I have been at this facility for the last 3 weeks every Friday morning, and I'll be back this Friday. I encourage anyone in Illinois to join me 7 to 9 a.m. at 1930 Beach Street, B-E-A-C-H. This was, as I said, the third time that ICE has done this to me. It's probably the most violent occasion of throwing me to the ground. But essentially, a car was about to run over a fellow protester. And so I went to check on that person. And that was all the justification an officer needed to pick me up and throw me to the ground, despite being half his size. And what I really want to stress here is that is what these officers are willing to do when there is press and cameras around. The reason we are protesting at this facility is because they are committing human rights abuses within the Broadview processing facility. It is a processing facility, so people are not supposed to be kept there for more than 12 hours at a time, but they are being kept for days or weeks without beds, without hot meals, without hygienic products. And if they are willing to do that to a congressional candidate on camera in front of press, imagine what they are willing to do to their detainees behind boarded up windows.
And Kat, you say you found two badges there. What did it say on the badges?
So I have no idea. The people who have accosted me, I have no idea who they are. I have no idea who these men are. They've had masks and sunglasses and hats sometimes when the sun is still down. We have seen two badge numbers the entire 3 weeks that we have been here, 4 weeks if we include a vigil earlier in the summer. And they were just numbers. There was no name and there was no identifying law enforcement agency. I have no idea if these men are actually affiliated with ICE. For all I know, this could just be random men who said, I'm going to put on a mask and a costume I got from Spirit Halloween to make me feel like I'm in the army and go and rough up some protesters today. We have no idea who these people are.
And in terms of what you know about the conditions in the Broadview facility, could you talk about that?
Yes, this Broadview facility is horrific. We've gotten reporting about dozens of people being kept in one cell. And these are our neighbors. These are pregnant women and grandmothers sleeping on concrete floors. I have not been inside the facility elected officials that have tried to inspect it have not been allowed inside. But I can attest that 2 weeks ago, when I saw prisoners being marched into a van, they were in the same clothes they were detained in. And we have no idea how long they had been in there. And they were in the same clothes they were detained in. The conditions at this facility are horrendous. They are committing crimes against humanity. And it is so important to remember that all of the treatment that we went through as protesters doesn't hold a candle to what these detainees are dealing with. I mean, ICE agents shot and killed a man two Fridays ago in the Chicago area. They are able to act with impunity. They are able to hurt whoever they want. Last Friday was the first time they had taken protesters inside the facility. And while the video of me being thrown to the ground has gone kind of viral, I want to talk about a few other things that happened that day because they haven't been covered as much. We had to play tug of war with a man's body to keep him from being abducted inside the facility. Right before we were tear gassed, ICE was carrying a van with a protester that had been detained inside of the van. We stood arm in arm. All of this is happening on Broadview public property on public streets. They tried to ram the van through us. A man fell in front of the van and the van was going to drive over his head. And I helped him up before that happened, but they were totally willing to do that. They shot a man in the face with a pepper ball bullet. They tear gassed us as they were trying to drive a car through a crowd. And then after that, they threw a tear gas canister at the press area, very intentionally, after protesters were already dispersing, because, you know, we were coughing and trying to get tear gas out of our eyes.
Ghazale, you are running for Congress, congressional candidate in Illinois' 9th district, which includes Chicago. The election is in November of 26, the ultimate election. Why are you running for Congress?
I'm a researcher and journalist who covers the far right. I have spent my career de-radicalizing and educating people on far right narratives and misinformation. I have spent my career, just as my colleagues have, trying to get Democrats to put up a resistance to the far right, to understand that the old playbook is gone and that it's not coming back. And I don't feel like our leaders are doing that. And so I got sick of waiting around and I decided to run the type of campaign I think we should. And that is with unapologetic progressivism, anti-fascism, and using our resources to materially improve people's lives right now. So we do voter outreach, but our campaign office also doubles as a mutual aid hub. We don't ask for $500 a plate at an event. For our kickoff event, for instance, we ask people to bring a box of pads or tampons for Chicago's Period Collective. We are about mobilizing people on the ground right now and making politics as accessible as possible, while also not compromising on basic human rights.
And you're running for the seat to replace Jan Schakowsky, who's retiring. There are several other candidates running in that field right now. Why do you think that voters would be best choosing you as the candidate?
You know, Illinois does a lot of things right, and that's the reason they aren't dealing with, until very recently, people like Stephen Miller and Elon Musk on a daily basis. I have been. I am the only candidate in my race with a track record of fighting and winning against the far right. I am the most effective communicator in my race, and I am the only candidate in my race to have the majority of her money come from small dollar donations. We've raised over $1 million, and our average donation is just $32. We have over 7,000 volunteers, and that's not because I'm some force. It's because people want progressive policies. They want common sense policies. They want a center that recenters voters. And that's what we deserve from our leaders.
Kat Abu-Ghazaleh, I want to thank you for being with us. Progressive congressional candidate in Illinois 9th District, which includes Chicago. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.